Well, hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me on this week's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Always appreciate you spending time out of your busy day to give me a watch and a listen. I'm grateful for you. Grateful for almost 200 episodes now over the last 6.5 years. It's amazing that you guys continue to tune in, but it never goes unappreciated. So I think you're going to enjoy today's episode. It's an issue that all of us in healthcare face. I face it in the hospital. I face it when I go to pharmacies. I face it when I go to physician offices. And that's the workforce challenges that we're dealing with in healthcare. And so today's guest is Brock Hughes with Propel Clinical. Brock and I have known each other for about a year now. He and Propel have a wonderful solution for some really difficult workforce issues. And so I'm going to let him talk a little bit now. Hey, Brock, tell my audience a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, wonderful. And about Propel Clinical. Kevin, I like to start off with the things that matter. So I am a husband and a father of 2 young girls. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and am a very blessed and fortunate man. And I've gotten to do a lot of fun things in my career so far. I've been in healthcare entrepreneurship for probably the last decade. Before that, I spent some time in commercial real estate development and then healthcare sales prior to that, and have had awesome partners along the way who know a lot more than me. I think it's always important as a non-clinician to have really strong, smart clinician partners as well as smart business partners. Right. And so throughout my career, I've been able to do that. I've been involved in an employer-sponsored direct primary care business in the past. I'm involved in an ambient AI documentation solution with the same partners. And then finally, Propel Clinical, which is solving a really big problem that often gets overlooked because at the end of the day, it's not sexy, not fancy. It's not healthcare, AI, and crazy technology with huge valuations. But to your point, it's a massive problem. It's a workforce labor problem. And at the end of the day, healthcare is a deeply, deeply personal issue for so many patients, for every patient for that matter, but for so many people that, really providing smart people in these roles that are massively important within healthcare is really important. And so what we do at Propel Clinical is we take pre-meds, pre-PAs, pre-nurses, even pre-MHAs and other early career entrants that are interested in healthcare. And we pair them almost with like fellowship opportunities. So we're putting these folks who even sometimes are still in their undergraduate studies, but oftentimes in their gap years before they get into med school, PA school, et cetera, getting those clinical hours. And we put them in entry-level roles. So in the past, these candidates had gone into generally a lot of medical scribing roles, right? Even research, you see a number do that, but a lot of medical scribing roles. Well, with the introduction of ambient AI documentation tools, scribes are kind of going the way of the dodo bird. And so we've really seen is, and through our conversations, we talk to clinicians, and clinicians say, well, I was a medical scribe and it was paramount. It helped me so much with medical school, helping my practice today. We owe these candidates opportunities to get experience in healthcare before they take out hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt and find out they don't want to do it. And so it works for clinicians. We really employ the clinicians of the future. It works for administrators and healthcare systems and medical groups as they really try to figure out how are we going to overcome the supply demand burden with so many of these support roles in healthcare, which we can talk about here in a moment. And then it's massively valuable to the candidates we employ, where they're getting experience, they're understanding, do I want to work in healthcare? No surprise to you, Kevin, healthcare is very hard. So if you're not mission aligned, probably in the last 6 months and say, I'm going to get something else. So that's what we do. We really look to bring in, candidates who are interested in healthcare, be that on the clinical side or the business side. We put them in roles, we train them, we manage them, we help them get into med school, PA school, et cetera, on the back end. And then we constantly replace those candidates. So there's really no gap in coverage or no open positions. It's really kind of the you train your replacement kind of model on the job. So that's what we do at that level.
Yeah. Very good. You know, and a couple of things. I mean, you mentioned something in training your replacement. That's not something that folks in healthcare do well. You know, throughout my career, succession planning was rarely talked about because senior executives like myself, we expected to work until we dropped dead at our desk. And so that's been a real deficit across the board in the industry. But really, you know, let's stop considering this as being temporary. Excuse me. This isn't a temporary issue. You know, before COVID, we were already seeing nursing shortage and shortages of other tech type positions, and COVID just exacerbated that. So what are you seeing that executives are doing differently now than they were doing in 2020 and even before that in and around the workforce?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kevin. I mean, I think, you know, COVID changed so much in healthcare, as you know. I think the staffing challenges that people wanted to believe were temporary have now at this point, people have accepted that they're not temporary. And so the exploration of what's a solution look like, what solutions are out there that allow us to reduce our premium pay pools, right? Travel nursing is still running rampant. A bunch of executives tried to put the kibosh to it, but at the end of the day, if you don't have nurses and nursing support roles and registration and all these other, you know, roles that help the wheels of healthcare and the wheels of a practice turn, you can't see patients, right? And so I'm seeing a lot of investment in this workforce development area. We see executives and more health systems really emphasizing workforce development through expanded partnerships with tech schools, with nursing programs, trying to start, let's take an imaging tech or an MRI tech, for instance, trying to partner with the tech school while the student is in there, introducing them as, you know, an imaging tech assistant or some other role like that, so they can work through school. What it does is it enables the system to kind of go ahead and invest in their employee before they become their employee, while still making the existing staff, the existing, let's say, MRI tech, which there's a massive supply demand balance, allows them to be more efficient and really practice at the top of their certification and license. And so we're seeing massive investment in those workforce development programs. I'm also seeing, you know, much to, you know, my good fortune, I would say, we're seeing executives say, okay, the old days of having an agency partner or an MSP that manages all of this and they just go find and compete for the same labor pool isn't really going to work anymore. And so how do we look at using a different profile of a candidate than what we've historically done? Again, just because that supply demand imbalance is so off on every entry level position, and not even entry level position, but early career positions in healthcare. So I'm seeing a lot more creativity, a lot more willingness to partner, and even to develop new positions, right, that would support a nurse, right? The same way, you know, a certified medical assistant did or a patient care tech did. It's okay, well, that's great, but now we've got to support our support roles because there's a shortage of those certified people as well. So I'm seeing a lot of creativity and a lot of flexibility from workforce development partnerships and programs, even down to the high school level. I've heard of some systems partnering to train, you know, seniors in high school for when they get out of school. So a lot of flexibility, a lot of creativity, a lot of willingness to look at different solutions.
Yeah, I mean, that's good to hear because in the past, we, and I'm going to use the generic we, in healthcare leadership, we've been pretty short-sighted. Yeah, you know, we've been focused so much on, you know, on keeping our staffing levels low. We've been focused on keeping our wages lower, our SWB expenses lower, and that's appropriate to do. But it's a real short-sighted solution because, you know, and you just mentioned the fact we've got a labor shortage across the board, and COVID just exacerbated it. And not only did COVID exacerbate it, but the students that were in schools, whatever level of school during that time, didn't get the type of education that they deserved and that people before them got. And so you've got a number of people who are ill-prepared to learn, let's say. And so why wouldn't you, as a healthcare administrator, look at these high-performing kids that are in the pre-programs, like you said, you know, pre-med, PT, pre-nursing, whatever, who are already made the decision to be invested in healthcare? Why? And gap years are becoming more and more common. They're becoming more and more important for people to really, you know, so they're not kind of wandering in the wilderness trying to figure out what they want to do. It helps them hone, you know, where they're going to be. But why not take advantage of that? And I'll bring them into your organization at a good wage to allow them to learn. And as you said, you know, you're bringing people into your organization. You're able to recruit them while they work for you. And so why not do that? So you know, like you said, there are a lot of health systems that are starting to lean towards this. But why aren't more health systems structuring some sort of a clinical fellowship or a bridge year?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and to your point, we're seeing the candidates need this experience more and more. For instance, you know, physician assistant schools are requiring 1,000 to 2,000 direct, you know, patient hours, right? And so these roles are great for that. But I think, you know, Kevin, you know, I think the tension here is a fewfold. One, you have a lot of stakeholders within, you know, especially a large medical group or healthcare system. You know, you talk to the operator. The operator's like, yes, I need all the help I can get. You talk to HR. HR is like, wait, well, we have an MSP. I'm not sure how this works or how this fits. Or maybe they're both on board. Then it's like, hey, we got to go talk to the department leaders because this is a little bit different than something they've ever realized or experienced. The other reality here is a lot of groups, a lot of health systems don't tap preclinical labor in the way they should because they're scared of the turnover, right?
Yeah.
Make no mistake about it, we don't want our employees to stay for more than 2 years. If they stay for more than 2 years, we haven't helped them in the way we should.
Yeah.
They're not in med school, they're not getting in PA school, nursing school, et cetera. And so there is turnover. And in my conversations, I get that a lot. Well, this is still going to cause turnover. And what I try to help them realize is this is planned turnover. Because our employees, the intent is for them never to be a full-time employee for their career, right? Which is what I think a lot of healthcare system execs are hoping for is I want career employees. We know that they're going to last, I think our average tenure is about 15.4 months, right? Mm-hmm. We know that and they know that. And so because we set that expectation up front, we create really, really awesome transparency between us and our employees where we know of our, you know, over 300 employees, we know, you know, that, you know, Janet Smith, it has scored a 520 on her MCAT. She had a 3.8 at Wake Forest and that she's getting interviews at all of her top med schools. Well, guess what? We know she's probably matriculating this year. And so we can plan now in, you know, March to replace Janet. And we can also know that Janet says, hey, I want to travel Europe for the month before I go to medical school. So my last day is going to be, you know, June 28th. So now we know we need to hire Bobby Jones, you know, beginning of June, we run him through all the onboarding, we manage all that, all the training, all of that information. And then he'll actually train with Janet before Janet leaves. So he picks up all the nuances. So I think the turnover can scare folks away. Also, what stops them from managing this themselves is this candidate pool, right? They may still be an undergraduate, so they're not working full time, or they may be studying for their MCAT. So managing their schedules can be really challenging. So that's why you wouldn't do it in-house. As you think about somebody else doing it, you doubt their ability to do that. we've built the processes and workflows, and we have the people so that we're managing. Sometimes in college towns, we're going to manage three people across a one FTE patient care tech, but the hospital doesn't have to manage those three FTEs.
Yeah.
We're those three, you know, bodies. We manage them into the one role. So we take a lot of that burden off it. So it's just really, it's a paradigm shift a little bit. It's different than how a lot of healthcare systems have ever done it before in the past. And Kevin, as you know better than I do, healthcare so highly regulated. The risk of trying something new is so high. If you fail, we're dealing with patient lives. And so change takes time. But we're seeing interest and adoption of this profile, of this personnel increase, really at increasing rates into these other entry-level healthcare roles.
Yeah.
Also, kind of last point, Kevin, sorry. I think what we also hear a lot of times is HR will say, well, you know what, for every entry-level role I open, I have 250 applicants. And my point to them is, wow, that's a lot. How many are qualified and how many recruiters do you have running through those names, right? Yeah. And then my follow-up question is, okay, well, what's your turnover in those roles? And so what oftentimes is happening, because the administrative burden is so high to go through 250 applicants for one role, they are one opening, they oftentimes are starting at the top of the list who applied first. And so they're not getting down to the highest quality of candidate. It's just who was first, who was second, who was third. And so that's another reason is people look at volume and then mistakenly maybe prescribe high candidate applicant volume to quality of workforce, which I think is a risk.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it being a paradigm shift. It's almost a paradigm shift back to the way labor was, you know, at this level when I was younger. Yeah. Because, you know, everybody my age worked in a fast food type environment. Okay. And it was never meant to be a career. It was meant to be that after school job where I made a little bit of money, where I learned how to deal with people, you know, I might get a little leadership managerial experience. And then we went away from that, where every job was thought of, hey, this is your career. And we expect you to stay. And I loved what you said about, hey, it's planned turnover. And in this instance, that's a good thing because you're getting engaged labor who wants to learn from you, who is a potential long-term employee, and you're able to train them like you would want them to work for you if they became a long-term employee. But you're giving them an opportunity to learn and move on to the next step of their career. And if their career includes coming back to you, that's great. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. So, okay, we're talking about all these gap year students, and integrating them into hospitals and clinics in larger numbers. You know, as a healthcare exec, you start thinking about, you know, what kind of issues will this bring? So what kind of guardrails should you have in place to protect patient safety and reduce your liability and avoid simply creating that shadow labor force of just a warm body?
Yeah, no, that's right. I think it comes down to a few things. It comes down to training. Well, it comes down to hiring, right? Then it comes down to training, and it comes down to really, really tight job descriptions and understanding. I mean, I think at the end of the day, as we've moved into more and more of these, we kind of bucket two types of roles where we support our partners. One is, I have these roles, turnover is really high, it's impacting patient satisfaction, et cetera. So let's think about like a patient care tech, an uncertified medical assistant, even in some of the administrative type roles where we're talking about like patient services reps or back to the clinical, like phlebotomists, et cetera, right? Those are roles that have defined job tasks, defined functions, defined roles and responsibilities. So in there, we with the health system partner will train to those jobs specifically, right? And then we make sure they understand, you know, the EMR well. They understand HIPAA, right? So the guardrails are up for these candidates in the same way it would be up for any other employee of the hospital, right? They run through the same programming, same training we have. And a lot of times they still run through a onboarding and certainly on the job training for the health system. So we're working with really, really smart, motivated preclinical candidates. So they pick up that information really, really quickly.
Okay.
And so the guardrails are there. By the nature of just the training and just the definition around the roles. So those are really easy. What gets a little bit more, just the attention to detail is a little bit higher here is when we are creating new jobs, right, within a system. Let's say a health system is having issues with patient satisfaction in their emergency departments, for instance, right? And they say, hey, we don't have this now. Let's create a patient navigator. Your candidate profile would be perfect for it. And it's shift-based, and we need overnight coverage, weekend coverage, which is great for undergraduates, obviously, because they're not in class during those times. And so what we do is we go in, we shadow the unit, we talk to the nurse managers, the nurses, the physicians, the you know, everything, the department heads, the COOs, et cetera. And we create, we understand the need, the challenges, the obstacles, the constraints, and we create a job description in partnership. Right. Then from that job descriptions, we understand what permissions do they need in their specific EMR? What training do we need to run them through beyond what I kind of consider healthcare 101, which is, you know, medical terminology, HIPAA, AMP, depending on the role, those sorts of things. And then we can really define that. Right. Now, what I'll tell you, Kevin, is we're in the people business. As you know, if it was easy, everybody would do it. And my business probably wouldn't exist. So that doesn't mean there aren't issues, there aren't challenges, there aren't obstacles. We have management and operators at the site and offsite that deal with those as they arise. But we keep a pretty tight grasp on what's going on and making sure our training puts those guardrails in place.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of as somebody who was the preceptor for administrative residents for years. Yeah. There's a lot of work involved in that. And, you know, if you're doing it right, you're investing in them, you know, from a career standpoint, but also personally. And so you've got to find health systems that, number one, want to do that, or, you know, have people that want to do that. But number two, they've got to see the value of those, I guess I'll call it adjunct positions that aren't direct patient care, you know. Mm-hmm. You've got to see the impact that those positions make on patient care, even though they're not providing direct touch in many situations.
Okay.
So another thing, obviously, with the financial constraints that health systems and clinics are under now, yeah, can it make or does it make good financial sense to build these types of programs for the gap year students? You know, what's that ROI look like when you're factoring in, you know, all the things that are involved, like you said, recruitment and training and retention and loyalty and all of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can assure you, if it didn't make financial sense, we wouldn't be talking about it here today. You know, I think what we really find is this should be, and, you know, market changes. Mm-hmm. Downtown Charleston's more expensive than Columbia, South Carolina, for instance.
Sure.
It's just to use my backyard as an example. But what we typically find is the cost of benefits in health systems is massive. I mean, we're talking 30 to 35% of these more entry level, you know, labor rates, right? And so you start layering in those benefits and burden, an $18 or $20 an hour position gets really expensive really, really quickly. Right. And so by nature of just a direct comparison for ROI of what it costs the system versus what it costs to go through us, we are pretty close to a 1.0, you know, just a break even on that investment.
Yeah.
And then you start layering in, you start thinking about, okay, well, now we don't have to hire more recruiters. Now we don't have to deal with the onboarding. Mm-hmm. Now we don't have to deal with the scheduling and the management and the turnover and backfilling with premium pay, labor, what have you, right? That's where the ROI gets really, really silly. transparently, I typically like to just talk about the direct break even, mm-hmm. and all that other stuff is understandable. Now, going one step further, when we talk about these positions that I don't know if we're creating, but oftentimes we're filling that don't previously exist before we start working with them. Let's take like an imaging tech assistant, right? They're there so that the MRI tech can just do what only an MRI tech can do. Highest and best use, top of their, you know, certification stuff. They're rooming the patient, making sure the patient's dressed, getting them where they need to be, checking them in, all of those things, right? They're doing those sorts of activities. Now, in those settings, we typically see a 30% lift in the amount of images if they don't have that position previously, mm-hmm. the amount of scans they can do a day, a week, a month, a year, right? And so what is that reimbursement at, you know, I'll make up an MRI reimbursement of $500-$600. Yeah. What does that do when you can do 30% more an hour? Not to mention the downstream revenue that comes from the procedures. I've never operated a surgical unit or hospital, but or department, but from my understanding, oftentimes that imaging, that advanced imaging, is the bottleneck for the procedures, yeah. right? And so when you start looking at the direct ROI being break even, and then you can track this data and understand, wow, we're seeing, you know, we're increasing our procedures because we're seeing more patients, mm-hmm. we're getting more imaging. And on the flip side of that, patients are getting faster access to care.
Right.
Getting back to normal lives faster. I think oftentimes, like, we can forget that, right? In the value that provides to families.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's something that does get lost in the whole mix is the fact that patients do have choice and the systems and the clinics that provide them with the best service in their mind, that's who's going to keep their brand loyalty. And so it can be tough to monetize, but it's certainly real.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kevin, I'd just add even like, you know, the best, I'll keep picking on surgeons, right? Mm-hmm. The best surgeons are the hardest ones to get into.
Yeah.
So how do we even then on the back end with surgery, I worked in orthopedic devices for a number of years and I was in the surgical suite all day, the operating room all day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even tasks within that department that our candidates can step into, maybe that surgeon, maybe that room turns over 15 minutes quicker on every procedure
right.
that,
right.
and they can get another patient in, right? And so it's how do we get people, you know, our really goal is twofold. It's improving, you know, access to care and improving patient satisfaction, mm-hmm. just with the workforce we bring to the table.
Okay.
Kevin, I think you went on mute there.
Yeah. Sorry about that. So lastly, we've been talking about everything regarding this from the health system or the clinic side. Let's talk about the students in their gap year. You know, if they're spending this amount of time in a health system before applying for the advanced degree or before or whatever, how is this, you know, in your experience, how's this shaping their expectations of medicine or whatever discipline they choose to go into? And could it really improve that long-term retention aspect and limit the burnout that they may feel in their career?
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, that's a great question or a great point. I think this is massive. Healthcare is hard. You know that. Mm-hmm. Probably everybody listening to this to this podcast knows it as well. If you're not aligned with the mission of healthcare, you're probably not going to last very long in the field. And so I think, first off, you know, people, a lot of kids want to become physicians because that's what they're told to do when they're young, mm-hmm. right? They're like, oh, it's a great job. You should go to med school, PA school, nursing school. It's stable. You'll always have a job, et cetera. You make good money. But at the end of the day, if that's not how they're wired, then we're doing them a disservice. Yeah. And so I think it gives them that exposure beyond shadowing for a day or a week. We talked about shadowing mm-hmm. earlier. It gives them real hands-on experience when things don't go well and they have responsibility for it going well or not, right? And it's somebody's it's somebody's health or somebody's child's health.
Yeah.
Then they get to see that weight of that, of their job, and they get to say, okay, is this what I want to do long term? Mm-hmm. They also get to see, let's say we have an employee who wants to be a physician. Well, they've served as, let's say, a patient care tech. Well, now maybe they have a little bit more empathy later when they come in the room or the surgical suite and things aren't exactly how they wanted it to be, or as they move into leadership within the department or the system, and they understand, well, okay, there are more things going on. I've gotten that experience in the past, and I understand.
Yeah.
So it's paramount. Anecdotally, there's an individual who was a scribe with us in the past, went through medical school. Oftentimes says, you know, the first year of medical school was easy. I felt like I got a head start because I had so much exposure working in the emergency department. I'd seen so much, worked so closely with physicians and nurses that I knew a lot more than I otherwise would have going in. And it helped me understand, I love emergency medicine.
Yeah.
Right. For all of its flaws, I love emergency medicine. Yeah. And so I think it just gives people that experience to understand, this is my calling, this is my passion, and I'm going to work in healthcare versus somebody told me to, and now I'm $200,000 in debt, so I guess I'm going to work in it until I can figure something else out.
Yeah.
So it's really, really valuable, not to mention, I think this is a hypothesis, a lot of the people we employ, even if we didn't pay them, they'd want these jobs because it gives them such great clinical experience. And it still does help them stand out on their medical school applications, PA school applications, nursing school applications.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing too, and you kind of touched on it, the fact that, hey, I might think going in, I want to go to med school. And then you get in there and say, you know what? I have a passion for providing direct patient care. Maybe I should go to the nursing, nurse practitioner route versus medical school. Or yep. Vice versa, either way. So,
well, and Kevin, kind of final thought, like, it honestly, that worked for me. I thought I wanted to go into orthopedics. I got out of undergrad. I ended up getting a job as a medical device rep in soft tissue reconstruction was kind of where we focused. And I loved the job. I admired the surgeons, but I also realized, like, it wouldn't have been a good for my goals and the desire for the family I had and the family life I was going to have one day, or I wanted to have. It wasn't the right avenue for me, still knowing I wanted to work in healthcare. Yeah. And so still wanting to provide value, help solve people's problems, et cetera. Like, it kind of did the job of what we're trying to do now with these other roles. And it saved me a lot of time and a lot of money having that experience.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, Brock, I appreciate all that you've mentioned today. You're touching on a subject and a topic that all of us in healthcare have been dealing with specifically, over the last 10 years, but much longer than that. And I really think the fact that you have engaged people into helping these roles is really a key. So thanks for that. Any final
Kevin,
comment?
I my only comment is I just hope that as we continue, healthcare in America is, I wouldn't want to be sick anywhere else. And I actually have a daughter who has an incredibly rare lung disease and have had good experiences and bad experiences, both with care and, don't get me started on insurance, but have had those experiences. And, I just challenge you, me, anybody listening, like, we've got to be able to come to the table and be flexible and creative, not rigid and all-knowing, to come up with solutions, because access to care is only getting worse. The burden we're putting on providers and nurses and support staff is only getting worse. And we've got to come to the table and try to improve the system that we have, because it's what we got. And there's no silver bullet. So I just encourage folks to think about their workforce development and their employee personnel in not one solution, but hey, we'll work with agencies, we'll work with solution organizations, we'll work with tech schools, and let's try to build a program that really solves the challenges that we face today in healthcare.
Boy, that's a good final word, Brock. I can't really say much more or can't add anything else to that. So thanks for that. Thanks for being with me today. It was a real pleasure. Folks, Brock Hughes with Propel Clinical. If you have any questions about what they do, go to their website, contact Brock on LinkedIn. He'll get back to you pretty quickly. So with that, thanks again so much for joining me today on I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Take care, and we'll see you next time.